Welcome to my channel, or welcome back to my channel. My name is Zach. I am the Sociologist. I make thoughtful weekly videos about pop culture. And today I have a guest with me, Mr. Anthony Fantano, who has made some of the most influential music reviews on the internet and, like me, has been sent to internet jail many times for his hot takes. Anthony Fantano, I'm here to challenge you today. How does it feel?
How does it feel? I feel invigorated. I feel thrilled. Mm-hmm. I'm excited.
Were you waiting for me to call you bald-headed scallywag? I'll do it right now.
Do you rehash material? I didn't know you were a recycler. You know, I thought you were always onto a new thing. I thought you were always writing new material.
That's, you know what, actually, I'm getting a little lazy. I've got to come up with something better. I think your people call you melon, but that seems to be a term of endearment, not a derogatory term.
Yeah, it's more of endearment. But I mean, people have said it in the midst of negative commentary, you know, maybe in sort of like a, this is coming from a loving place, you know, sort of way.
Great. You get melon. I just get like the F slur or ogre or troll, something terrible, which really speaks a lot, I'd say, to the different audiences that we pander to or appeal to. So I want to start with the moment, because as we mentioned briefly in our prior interaction, we were both stars of the show. Huge roles. You definitely had a much more starring role than I do. So I wanted to know, how did it feel when you were approached for that project? Because I know you've been a fan of Charlie for a long time and you really loved Brat. Did it feel strange to be approached? Did it feel like Inception vibes?
You know, honestly, I didn't really like allow myself to at first believe it was even real. Because and we've talked about this, you know, I've done numerous reach outs over the years in terms of like, oh, we should have a conversation, we should do an interview, and you know, and there's been like some interest expressed there, but it's like never happened, and maybe it's just like, you know, being polite, but also simultaneously, and again, I'm, you know, kind of alluding to us talking about this, we sort of understand the optics of like, we're critics and we're commentarians and we're, you know, sort of like bringing this reputation of not always being positive about everything. So when artists or kind of creators decide to talk to us or do any kind of like integration, you know, they're sort of running that risk of like looking like they're aligned with us. And then maybe that moment comes around where, you know, we're critical of their work and, you know, it kind of bites them in the butt. And after they've kind of like endorsed us and given us this kind of like legitimacy in a way, which, you know, we don't want to bear that responsibility. We just want to do what we do and artists just want to do what they do. So I thought like, if I send this footage, like, I don't know, it seems like such a random thing that, and I didn't really know the gravity of the storyline at the time that I was like, this could 90% chance end up on like the cutting room floor. You know what I mean? So I'm not even really going to think of it too much. But, you know, I signed the release too and I sent the footage. And then when I, you know, actually saw people kind of like commenting on Twitter saying like, why is Anthony in the moment? And like sending me pictures of the screen while I'm on the screen. And like, holy crap, it actually happened. Holy shit. And, you know, then when I actually saw the movie itself, I thought the way I was worked into the storyline was really funny. I just thought it was like a really preposterous sort of thing. And that and the additional clip of the review at the start to sort of show the context of like, oh, here's how popular the album was. So, you know, it's a dead giveaway that the album's popular. Anthony gives it a positive review. So it was very flattering. It was very sort of like flattering, honestly, like more of, I think, and I know this doesn't, it's not going to read like this to most people, and that's fine. I think that's why this was like kind of safe for Charlie and her team to do. But like, you know, I know what it means. I can read it for what it is. You know, it says like, this means something. You know what I mean? The fact that this person went out of their way to say this or talk about this or engage with this in a very sort of positive fashion, you know, so it was validating. It was nice.
Yeah, I definitely think it was 100% a cosign of the influence and the impact that you have had on this new space. And part of why I wanted to talk to you is because I feel like in most jobs, you have someone that is like more successful than you that you can look up to and be like, how did they get to where they are? What did they do that I could replicate? And in this thing that we do, there is kind of no precedent. Like when I try and think of, what would I like to do? The only person I can think of that's doing something adjacent to what I want to do is you. So I was thinking, how do you think about yourself and your position? I mean, this is a great cosign for that Charlie gave you, but it's been, you've been doing this for a long time, a lot longer than me. So do you think of what you do as traditional music criticism, or do you kind of see it as like a hybrid role between like content creator? Because that really does change up the dynamic of being a critic per se.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think about the kind of dynamic that you've brought up a lot, because, like, you know, there isn't anybody who I look up to in that way. And it's not because, like, you know, I'm trying to portray myself and what I'm attempting here, what I've made my profession, is like this wholly original idea. But, like, you know, when it comes to talking about music on YouTube, talking about music on camera on a regular basis, you know, in sort of like a social media sense, there wasn't really anybody else there as an example for me prior. And those in music criticism who are like the big heads and are kind of like the movers and shakers and have had these kind of long-standing careers, you know, that people like me could look up to, some of those people have publicly hated my guts, you know? So it's like, even if I sort of like look at their, even if I look at their work, and I sort of like see it is a really impressive and amazing thing that they've sort of like, you know, been very consistently like, you know, diving into music and explaining the context around these albums and celebrating what they felt was like special music for decades and decades and decades. You know, simultaneously, it kind of stinks to sort of see that person turn around and be like, yeah, I don't care what this guy does. It's the fact that he does it on camera makes it completely irrelevant to me and not important. And, you know, who even cares? But, you know, and again, to sort of like flip it a little bit more, like I guess in a lot of ways, like I take a lot more influence, I guess, in terms of my delivery, in terms of, you know, the general presentation of what I do, from people who don't even talk about what I talk about, people who were very early in the YouTube space and sort of like, you know, giving impassioned commentary on politics or philosophy or video games and da 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 da. Or, you know, I was also interning a lot in the NPR space when I started, you know, which is where I sort of developed this very consistent radio voice sort of thing when I'm doing reviews and whatnot. So, you know, that's where a lot of my presentation comes from, honestly. Everything outside of that, as far as like, you know, the music takes and commentary, like for the most part, that kind of comes with just like talking music with my friends. You know, and just like giving recommendations to each other and all the music discourse that kind of came out of being in college radio for years and all of that. And just like kind of being deeply ingrained in a lot of like online music spaces, because, you know, I sort of got into, I've always been an enjoyer of music, you know, since I was a kid in the 90s. But like, you know, I kind of came of age and really got into music at the dawn of like, you know, the internet and file sharing and that sort of thing. And that, you know, sort of created a rabbit hole for me to get into these spaces where people were like obscure, you know, recommending obscure punk music and electronic music and hip hop music and so on and so forth. So, you know, a lot of the discourse and a lot of the opinions and a lot of the points of view that I have in terms of like, you know, what's good, what's not good, what kind of stands out as artistically significant comes from those kinds of spaces.
Oh, that leads very nicely into my next question. Thank you so much, Mr. Radio Man, for leading us right there.
Yeah, thank you for sending me the exact script beforehand of everything that you wanted me to say. And I just read it off the screen perfectly.
Of course. That's what we always do whenever we speak. We're basically just actors, like we were in the moment. But I think, you know, something that I resonate with that you're saying is a lot of the times, you know, the traditional gatekeepers of music criticism are like what we're doing don't like the form, and they really try and use the form to like invalidate the rigor or the work that's applied to how we come to our reviews and our conclusions. So I wanted to ask you a little bit more about your process. So like on a basic level, how much of your reviewing do you think is like a framework or a checklist versus like instinct? Are you at a point now where you don't have certain questions that you ask yourself before you approach a review, or do you just kind of instinctually let it fall out?
I think that's a really good sort of way to present it, because sometimes like people do approach me and are like, when you're reviewing something, is there like a criteria that you're working from? And while there isn't, because I feel like I'm always trying to do my best to review what I'm reviewing within the cultural and genre context that it exists in. And I know there are some people that don't always come at certain things from that perspective. In fact, like I would say, most of the angriest fans that sort of like might attack me over a review, while, you know, I think a lot of fans are capable of sort of seeing some of their favorite artists as having made a mistake or having made a record that's like not that great or underwhelming. I think a lot of them sort of more review or critique things from the context of like, how does this sound in their catalog? You know, and I think there's a lot of sounds and there's a lot of music that, you know, that could get a pass when you look at it merely from that perspective. You know, like if somebody's making a pop album, I'm trying to look at this within the context of like, how does pop sound right now? How does the sound compare to some of the most classic pop albums out there? You know, is this special at all in any way in terms of like the current field of pop? You know, are there 10 other artists out there who are currently either doing this or doing this better? You know, is like what I try to consider when I'm talking about, you know, the context of something. So I wouldn't say it's as much a criteria as much as it is a framework. Again, I like that word. And the reason I like framework is that when I'm coming into it, I'm looking to do my cute, corny little intro. I'm looking to give background on the lead up to the album, how I might have felt about previous records, maybe certain sort of like scenes or contexts or genres that artist music lands in or typically lands in. Are they switching it up entirely into something that goes in a different direction? Are they working with a producer or artist that they've been known to in the past? Like, I'm trying to sort of like take everything in from that perspective, you know, to kind of like give a recent example. And you and I have talked about this, like, when we sort of like dove into our conversation around the new Taylor Swift record. Not only am I going to look at that within the context of like, you know, broader pop music, but also she's working with Max Martin again. That information is going to make me think like, you know, not only am I going to think of this in the context of like pop music, Taylor's catalog, but specifically those records where she has worked with him in the past and how it measures up to those past moments too, you know, where they especially saw like a lot of success. So, you know, I try as much as I can to sort of like bring in all the context that I need, even if I'm not mentioning all of it in the review, because, you know, some records have a story that you could honestly talk about for half an hour and the review has to be like a certain length to be convenient for people. I sort of see the point of the review is like, I'm giving the audience a heads up in terms of like what they can expect. Is this worth their time? You know, I feel like if I make a review that's as long as the album itself, like what is even the point, you know? So it has to be broken down into some kind of bite-sized-ish way. And, you know, then from there, like once I kind of have that baseline structure, I'm kind of like, you know, answering the question, do I like this? Do I not like this? If I like it, how much do I like it? If I don't like it, how much do I not like it? And what are the things about the album each time that are standing out to me as positives, negatives? And how do they all add up or stack up at the very end in terms of whether or not this overall kind of like adds up to a positive experience, a negative experience, and then, you know, slap a score on it and kind of head out from there.
Yeah, I think I approach it in a very similar way. The framework is important because you need a structure to help guide the process. Because like you said, there are so many different ways that you can approach a review. Sometimes I want to spend, like, I'll choose whether it's like a TikTok review or a YouTube review, to depending on like how much I think the work deserves like more of an elaboration. But so much of what we do, I think, as well, that people forget, and this is especially prevalent for you because you are a tastemaker. When you give an opinion about an album, it really matters to people. So it is about taste. A lot of it is about what you personally like. We are not Wikipedia robots delivering like summaries. There is no one right way to review an album. There's no right perspective or opinion to have about an album. It is, as much as we try and like, you know, be fair and review things in context, a lot of it comes down to what you like, what you don't like, what your background with the music is. As you said, there are a lot of variables that go into it. And I think that people forget a lot of the time that when you tune into a review by a music reviewer online, you're tuning in to hear their opinion, their taste. You're not tuning in to have whatever you think confirmed back to you. And this is where I think a lot of the split of like audience reaction versus intent of reviewer comes into question, because I don't ever go into something wanting to pan it or wanting to, I don't know, be provocative. Those things kind of happen by accident. And it's always the things that I don't expect that are going to be provocative that are. So yeah, I think it's hard when you have to navigate being a, this is where the entertainment, like the creator versus the reviewer part also comes in, because not only are we doing review and trying to talk about music like fairly or in an interesting way, we're also making fun content that you want to watch. And so you need your little pithy one-liners. Like that's the personality, that's the piece of reviewing that is interesting that we get to do as creators that maybe you don't get to do when you're writing for Pitchfork or you have like a bunch of editors taking a pass over what you got to say. It can be more personal.
I mean, I would say that limitation is even there, doubly so, at least in terms of, you know, some of my observations in the influencer space, because it specifically when it comes to a lot of younger creators, because, you know, when you're making content and you're just first starting to gain an audience, one of the first things that, you know, you want to start doing, and it's a perfectly valid entitlement, is you want to start making money off of what you do, and you want to start turning it into your career and your job and so on and so forth. And I'm going to be doing a video about this soon, but like, you know, it's a pretty regular, open and common practice right now that, like, you know, rather than being legitimately a critic and somebody who creatively speaking is like calling balls and strikes, one of the first and fastest ways to kind of like monetize as a music commentator, especially in the short form space right now, is labels like Atlantic Records just like start reaching out to you and like, hey, will you take 200, 300, 400, 500, if they're being generous, dollars to
it's
sort of like, you know,
recommend
this artist, recommend this song, do a video talking about how great this track is, da 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 da. And, you know, I know some people rationalize this by saying like, well, like I'm helping an artist find their audience, and isn't that a good thing? Or maybe this is something I would talk about otherwise, so why don't I just take the money? But the thing is, like, you know, you're much of the time you're not publicly disclosing that this is sort of like a paid promotion, which it in fact is. And, you know, if you're not doing that, then you're sort of like betraying the trust that your audience is sort of like put into you to curate certain things for them, because they sort of like see maybe themselves in you a little bit, and they're trusting you to sort of like tell them what's worth their time and what's not. And, you know, you're kind of like selling out, Not to use a dated term, but like, you know, you're literally sort of like selling that trust that your audience has in you. And, you know, unfortunately, that's, I think a super common practice in the industry these days. You know, I think a lot of people who are, again, on the younger side and are doing that, I don't entirely blame them, because they did not start this system. They're almost second gen. A lot of the people who I know sort of like, you know, were on the front lines of kind of normalizing this have been doing that already for 2, 3, 4, 5 years. And I mean, in social media spaces, like, that's all you need for sort of like a generation of creators. The next gen who's going to be doing it their own way is coming up immediately after, because things evolve so quickly. So yeah, you know, this whole thing is already like a common established practice, and people aren't even questioning at this point. It's just the way the industry works now.
Yeah, I find that to be one of the most like disappointing, I guess, and disheartening parts of this process, is that I really, for a long time, trying to figure out how I could make the paid review model work. I was like, well, if I disclose that I'm working with a label, if I say that I've, you know, been contracted to give a review, and I promise honesty. And what I've realized very quickly is that the labels won't work with you on that. They don't want you to disclose, and they don't want you to give an honest opinion. They want you to only say something positive. So it's not, the value proposition there is not worth it to me, because, you know, for any creators watching this, maybe like you, your word as a reviewer, your taste, your word, your consistency, your honesty is the most important thing that you have. And that relationship you build with your audience that believes you're coming into reviewing with a good faith is completely eroded when you get even exposed for like one unpaid or one paid and covertly not disclosed ad. And it's interesting, because when I scroll my feed, I see people that are, you know, maybe of a similar size to me, that are 100% doing these paid reviews, because I've got them, I've had the proposal, and I've rejected them. So it's interesting to see, like, I think people need to be more aware of the fact that like 90% of the opinion-based content that you see on TikTok specifically is paid for promotion. I would say a lot of it is.
Yeah, no, a lot of it is. And look, this is not to sort of like completely look down on or poo-poo, you know, the idea of like getting paid. It's not about getting paid. It's not about the money in general. It's not as if I haven't take in sort of jobs or sort of opportunities that I would say are analogous in some way. Like, you know, looking at it from that same perspective of like, oh, this is something I would praise anyway. Recently, I wrote out, you know, I think like 1,700, 2,000 words for the liner notes of a reissue of the debut Velvet Underground album with Nico, which, I mean, I've already said hours of positive things about that album. And I was able to obviously publicly disclose all of it because my name is right there on the thing and I did a whole video about it. So, I mean, people sort of understood, you know, it's like, I've been very public about it, very open, very transparent. It's more the, it's more the lack of transparency about it that bugs me. You know what I mean? Like if, you were doing, or not you specifically, but if, you know, these individuals were doing like paid reviews, paid, you know, sort of like promotions, and it was, you know, sort of like mentioned what was and was not a promotion, like it would be a little bit clearer and I think be a little bit more sensible if it could just sort of be presented in a way that, you know, was just more transparent. I think it would be a lot better and be a lot more, you know, I think less icky. But I think we're sort of like just operating in very icky times.
I think so. And also, I think when you select honesty as your, sometimes I'm like, wow, I wish that I would just say positive things all the time and just lie, because I think, or just, you know, to take all of these paid deals, because I think it would just be easier. And also you receive like less blowback from your audience too, because unfortunately delivering a negative review gives you absolutely zero positive outcome. I would say like the labels don't like it. The artists don't like it. They often get mad and respond. It doesn't make people want to work with you. The fans get mad at you. It is actually, I would say, a net negative overall to be super, super honest about how you feel about anything really on the internet now, because there's just like a default love everything or hate everything. And there's kind of no space in between. But I wanted to ask you about like your relationship to artists and trying to find a way to maintain your like honesty and your integrity while, I don't know, I've seen you do interviews a couple of times, but a challenge that I'm navigating at the moment is that I have a lot of artists that will say to me kind of behind the scenes, like, I love what you do, really appreciate the work that you do, but I'm too scared to, I would not go on camera with you basically without having there be like a list of questions that I know what's going to be had. And in the call her daddy world where, you know, these publicists are puppeting all of the major interviewers and stuff, it's very difficult to pitch to an artist why they should come to you and be challenged on their creativity. So I found it, I have a couple of people that I'm hoping to interview soon, but I found it generally quite challenging, especially in pop, to find people that are open to doing that. Have you found that to be a challenge when you've tried to do outreach? How important is like speaking to artists and doing interviews? How much of your like business model or part of your offering do you want that to be, and can it be?
Doing interviews is honestly like almost 0.5% of my business model when I'm doing an interview. And some of them do very well. Like, you know, recently I did a really great, you know, interview, or it was very quick. There were more questions I wanted to ask for sure. But it in terms of views, it did really well. The conversation that I did with Damon Albarn of Gorillaz. And I'm trying to line up a few more, soon that I'm doing on the channel. But for the most part, the interviews don't get nearly as much traffic as the reviews do. And as like you have found, a lot of the time when I am reaching out, people are either sort of like busy or there's that hesitance there, which I sort of like, you know, understand. And, you know, early on when I first started dipping my toes into interviews, and I did have like a lot of willing participants, you know, I quickly understood kind of like that dichotomy, because I did run into a few situations where, you know, I talked to somebody maybe a few weeks out from the album cycle, and then the album comes out and I'm like, I actually am not that crazy about this, you know? And it's like, and I actually say my real opinion about it, and then afterwards the artist is like, what the fuck? You know, it's yeah. Like, I thought this was going to be a positive thing. And, you know, I understand how that feels from their perspective, which is why sometimes, like, if I don't know how I'm going to feel about an album yet, I actually don't do the reach out, you know, or I won't follow up with it completely, because again, it's like, I don't want, not only do I not want the awkwardness of that, or not even so much the awkwardness, but the confusion that my audience is going to feel on that from my side. But also I don't want the artist to have to go through what they're feeling on their side, you know, from like having come off of like a freshly negative review and then interacting with me off of that, you know, especially if it's an artist who, maybe in my eyes, they're kind of like a legacy act. They've come out with so many records, and maybe I've been praising them for years. You know what I mean? And maybe it's like this one album that I'm like not super crazy about. So a lot of the time when I will, you know, do an interview with somebody like Hemlock Springs, for example, you know, who I talked to not too long ago, who I think is, you know, one of the really great up and coming pop girlies. If you have not heard the new album and the recent EP, I think her work is great and it's very fun. And it's some of the most vibrant and, you know, very eclectic pop music we've heard in a minute. But, you know, I'd already heard that album and thought the record was great and thought the world of her and this cycle that she's in the midst of. So, you know, and she's still very much on the come up. So there's still like definitely from I can see from her perspective, like an added benefit of continuing to like promote and put yourself out there, like any opportunity to put yourself on a platform that you can, you know, is a good thing. So, you know, I try to sort of like take into consideration, is this something I already feel very positively about? And being in the industry for as long as I have and knowing what I know about sort of like artist optics and artist promotion, is it actually going to be worth this person's time, you know, to like come on here and talk to me? You know, there are some artists who I know there's like a mutual appreciation there and we like each other's stuff and maybe I gave them a positive review, but maybe they're super busy, they have a million things going on, and I like really try to like, you know, independently assess, would this actually be worth this person's time to like come talk to me, you know, is this just like going to be kind of like lost in the sea of all the other promotions that, you know, they're doing. So, you know, I try to look at it as objectively as possible and, you know, kind of come to the realization that like, as much as interviews can be fun to do sometimes, like the bread and butter of what I do is the reviews, it's the opinions. And, you know, no matter how fun a certain interview might be from my perspective, I can't betray the main thing that I do in order to kind of like, you know, move over into this other space, especially since like what I know of the interview space, I could never operate in there in the way that I do in the review space. You know what I mean? As you were kind of like referencing Call Her Daddy, but it's not even just about a specific podcast. It's really the whole sort of like internet media space that is so pre-planned, is so promotional, is so, you know, I guess like as bland as it could be. And, you know, I sort of understand because like controversy is potentially like a career killer, you know, in this day and age. You know, the only people who I sort of like see that sort of, you know, do functionally operate as interviewers and people who engage directly with artists and engage directly with culture who can afford to rock the boat are people who have like been doing it for so long that, you know, they almost have like an unbreakable level of sort of legitimacy that even like, you know, a weird interaction can't really change. A guy like Charlamagne the God kind of like comes to mind in the hip hop space, for example.
Or like a Louis Theroux. He seems to be able to get away with asking people outrageous questions, really great questions, questions that other people I think would be a little bit too scared to approach an artist with, that artists feel as though they have to answer because it's coming from someone that means well and has like a good faith interpretation and is also putting them on to an audience that maybe they wouldn't reach otherwise. I think I'm kind of picking up what you're putting down about, I personally also like the interview that I've done so far has been with Adela right before she blew up. And I think the best time for us to be
her new KGB track was very fun.
I've been on the Adela train for a while now. And one of the best parts about interviewing someone, I think, when they're like on the come up is that you have the chance to help them get there a little bit or just platform them a little bit. And maybe, you know, they're usually already on their way to stardom anyway, but just like giving them that little zing or boost. Our video did really well together, did really well on TikTok too. And that is really fulfilling, but also, like you said, not kind of the main purpose or point of what I do, because it's the honesty, it's the review giving. Is there an interaction with an artist that really stands out to you as hilarious or embarrassing or humbling? I can share one first. I recently had, a couple of months ago, Charlie Puth sent me a stream of TikTok DMs. And he said the nicest stuff about like how essential he thinks my voice is in the industry. He's been telling his label that they need to be paying more attention to me, blah, 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 all this stuff. And then he was also telling me that he loves this new album of his is going to be great. He's so sure that I'm going to love it. We're looking for a new main pop boy. It's going to be amazing. I hear the album and it's like no offense to Charlie Puth, but like below AI Slop. Like it was worse than the Ed Sheeran record, and that is really saying something. And unfortunately, I then had to come out and make my review. And I did feel a little bit bad at first. And then I put it out and it was, you know, I didn't hold back. I was a little scathing. And he reposted it and then unreposted it on TikTok. And I was like, sometimes I just wish that I could operate in a lane where the artists just don't see what I do, because it just, it gets a little confusing.
Well, I think like, I think that's a fair, I think that's a fair want. And maybe there are some people like who would react to that and say like, well, what does that mean? You're a critic who can't handle criticism, or you don't want to hear feedback about what you do. No, it's the, what we do is not for artists, you know, and that's not, mm-hmm. that's not an above you kind of thing. That's not like a pretentious statement. That's not like, oh, artists, like, fuck you. That's like, we're not doing what we do to recommend our, we're not hoping artists watch our content and are like,
take points.
This person gave me all the answers I need to make a perfect record. That's not what we're doing. As we're not giving it, this is not an advice session. This isn't a songwriting workshop.
Therapy.
You know what I mean? Like, that's not what it is. Like, we're music fans. We're talking with other music fans about what we feel about the music, and we would love to hear, pissed off or not, what other music fans think about the record, you know, like, because we already know 9 times out of 10, and I've had very positive interactions with Charlie too. Charlie's also sent me his music and hyped up his music, you know, here and there a little bit, which is fine.
You're an artist.
You should promote.
He's
actually putting his stuff out there. That's good. That's what you should be doing. That's your job. You know, I was just watching sort of a YouTube commentary last night on this guy just talking about, you know, what sucks about being in bands and the music industry these days. And he's like, when you get to a certain point, you're doing way more promotion than you are songwriting. And it's true.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, mm-hmm. don't get into the music industry if one of your favorite things to do isn't promoting.
It's more that than anything else. All your
right, exactly.
time sucking stuff is not the creative process anymore. It's like the creative process has to be really condensed so that you can get it out as a product and then sell it and make it efficient so that you then have more space, more runway to have more condensed spaces where you can make more music. It becomes, yeah, the problem with the content machine is that it becomes less and less about actually being able to be creative. And I think like trickle down, we can see that with our reviews too. Like there are a lot of times where I would love to take a couple of days to really sit with something and think about it before turning out my review. But you know, the way that the algorithm works, sometimes you have to put a review out before you maybe are really ready to. And a lot of the times I'll put out a review and then a couple months later, I'll have an epiphany or the artist will release something else and I'll come back to it and think, okay, this is deeper or more complex than it was when I listened to it 2 or 3 times before I actually had to review it. But the pressure of the algorithm is like taking over all parts of the industry, I feel.
No, it's true. I mean, you know, as valid of a critique as, and I've seen some artists like voice this, you know, who are like, how are you going to do a review of my album in like 4 hours? You know, it's like, you know, you go on the internet and people are already sort of like they got their full review out as soon as the album is like dropped. You know, it is true. It is unfair. It is really, you know, stupid and ridiculous. But like simultaneously, most records these days, and I think this is very unfortunate, most records these days, by the time 72 hours is up, people aren't even talking about it anymore. You know, right. People are just done talking about it. Unfortunately, with the way discourse works and the algorithm works and the speed at which people are consuming certain things, the discourse about a certain record is like, you know, dead once 3 days is up, unless, you know, it somehow sort of like maintains classic status and it's worth going back to years later. But outside of that context, like most people are just kind of done talking about things in a very quick way, which is like why every single week I try to go through my calendar and assess like what are the albums that I'm, you know, genuinely interested in but are going to have the biggest hype cycle. How can I get that review out Monday? And then the other albums that I'm really into but maybe aren't going to be as driven by greater discourse, can I hold off a minute on and review later in the week and, you know, sort of like parse it out that way. You know, the Lady Gaga review comes out Monday, the, you know, sort of like obscure indie band review, comes out Friday, you know,
Friday at 11 PM.
Oh my God. So, you know, and, It's just the way the internet works now. You know, if I knew there was just as much sort of like, you know, likelihood that the Lady Gaga review would get, you know, the views that I'm looking for it to get Monday versus Friday, then it would be whatever, you know. And there was a time where it was a little bit more like that, and you could sort of like take maybe a bit more time with an album, especially in an age where like advanced promos were more of a thing rather than just like kind of like dropping the album out of the blue because people are afraid of leaks, you know, of course. You know, we and that's even been a thing recently. I think, Jessie Ware held off, I think, on her new record for another week or so past when it was supposed to drop because there was a leak, you know, on the album, unfortunately. But that sort of like created a space where reviewers and fans alike are all sort of like hearing the album at the same time. And there's not really enough time to, I think, like kind of digest, you know, and it does lead to a lot of album cycles that personally I see, you know, what you're talking about having epiphanies on certain records. Sometimes what I see these days is I'll talk about something. I will kind of get into what I don't like about it. And then 2 weeks will pass by and the album sales have either like, you know, not gone anywhere or they've tanked, or I'm seeing these random takes on Twitter like 6 months later being like, you know, come to think about it, I don't really like this album. You know, it's like, why did we hype this up? Or people coming out to be like, hey, is it safe to say this sucks now? Yeah, and I'll like, see hundreds of replies being like, yeah, it actually did kind of suck. And I'm like, well, what the fuck? Mm-hmm. You know, like, but
you take
like,
all the blows for saying it first.
Right, and then you watch your takes get regurgitated.
That's a big part of it too, as well. And like the vitriol that people give you when they don't agree with you or when you deliver something that is maybe an unpopular or a hot take can be difficult to deal with. I think it's especially difficult, I found, when artists get involved. When artists join in the pile-on on the critic, that's when it kind of goes into like a different stratosphere, when you get singled out by an artist, I suppose. That kind of happened for me with Zara Larsson and her Midnight Sun review. She definitely advertently or inadvertently directed a lot of negative attention my way that caused the discourse about my review to go on for a lot longer than the discourse about the album itself went on. They were still talking about this like 2 months ago. The record came out in September. Like it's been a minute. So has there been a moment where you've had an artist kind of like put their spoon into the pot and you felt that it has given consequences like kind of wider than what you would normally experience from giving a bad review?
Yeah, no, for sure. It's happened here and there. I'm like, and there's been so many sort of like weird examples, and it's they never pan out the same way. It's all sort of like super case by case. I just, you know, I try to just have the same reaction to it regardless, because the thing is like, if I you could hate what I do and you could hate me as much as I want or as much as you want. You know, that's fine. But if I allow that to sort of like change me, then that's fucking with my work and that's fucking with my job. And I feel like there's a lot of people that don't like quite understand my capacity for that. I was just like enjoying the new Vince Staples single yesterday. And, you know, outside of a couple of times, like where I've kind of panned a record or two of his, like I've given him mostly positive reviews, but, you know, by that same token, there's this like infamous podcast interview he did with like another artist or another band. And he like bleeped my name out in the midst of this, but you can very clearly tell he's talking about me. And he goes through this like detailed story about how he would kill me if he had the opportunity. It's like this very detailed story with like a cartoony kind of description of like,
you're Chun-Li. You know,
leaving me abandoned on an island with like, you know, my guts spilled out of my body and goats like eating me alive. You know, it's like a very detailed thing. And, you know, I still think the guy's music is great, you know?
I mean, that's the thing also is that like, it's, I think artists, because we're critiquing something that is so personal to them, it feels like a personal attack when you say that you don't like something. And I completely get that. But also I think it's important to remember that when I'm approaching a review, I am never really trying to personally attack the artist. I'm trying to think of an example of maybe when I was trying to personally attack an artist. I think sometimes I will dial it up for Ed Sheeran just because I think that he deserves it. And that personal element comes from a wider disagreement I have with his entire being as a creative. But it, being fair to artists that maybe you don't like or don't give a good opportunity to is definitely something that I have considered. And I want to pivot a little bit to asking you about a couple of your reviews and maybe doing a little compare contrast. And the reviews of yours that I want to talk about are your Somber review of his record and the Addison Rae review. So I think these records actually have quite a lot in common. They're both like major label debuts from 20-something, like new, very internet native artists. And I think you definitely, in my opinion, you can correct me at any time if I'm wrong, I think you frame Somber as a very promising artist with a foundation and Addison as basically someone who's just trying to do a brand expansion rather than like an artist, I would say. So in your mind, what do you think separates an artist from a brand in that sense?
I think I'm not sure how to approach, I guess, like that question. I guess I'll just sort of put it this way. Like for me, between those two records and artists specifically, what kind of cuts between both of them for those releases is the songwriting on the Somber album stood out to me a bit more. It sort of felt like he was kind of like, you know, driven as a songwriter. And I sort of see him primarily as a songwriter because of sort of the quality of the songwriting on that record. I feel like Addison's songwriting isn't as boned up as her aesthetics at this point. You know, like there are a lot of things around Addison that I think are impressive. I've liked, you know, pretty much every clip of every live performance I've seen of her so far. I think that she's somebody who clearly has taste and is pulling from interesting places. But like lyrically, melodically, I'm not as, you know, sort of like into sort of like the substance of the songwriting. But simultaneously, Somber is somebody who, in the wake of that record, despite me seeing a lot of validity to the songwriting, I have found to be unbearably cringe in almost every other context.
Well,
like the live performances are cringe. And also I think his two latest tracks have been kind of disappointing. You know, it's like one of my major bones to pick with his debut album is like, I feel like a lot of the songs are there, but the production kind of sucks. And the presentation is just sort of like unnecessary. You're giving us this like kind of fuzzy, noisy, indie rock coded kind of album. But when you look at the record at its core, it's not that kind of album. It's just as like cleanly structured a pop record as any other pop release out there today. Why does it sound like this when it's like not the thing that it's like pretending to present as? And, you know, while the newer tracks have had some cleaner production on them, which I think makes them a little bit more listenable, the songs are just like kind of falling flat and I feel like aren't really sort of like, you know, blossoming into a new version of themselves with kind of like, you know, the improved production quality. So I think like already in a very early stage, like Somber is kind of like painting himself into a corner a little bit. Whereas at this point for Addison, I am seeing currently like more, I think, potential in what she's doing. You know, I think there's like, you know, while there are things about her music so far that I haven't really liked, honestly, I know this is hard for a lot of pop stans to kind of like, you know, see, I chalk it mostly up from just being like, just starting out. You know, it's like, I know she's had like a big blow up and she's kind of like, you know, begun her music career with this big platform. But, you know, unfortunately, like some people need some time to like incubate and work on their shit and just get better, you know, and it just kind of is what it is. I think another kind of like prime example of an artist who for years I gave pretty negative reviews and I've like very much warmed up to her stuff. And I think also she's like gotten objectively better in every possible measurable way as an artist and a songwriter is Lana Del Rey. You know, I think she's somebody who, you know, could have still gotten to the point that she's at now, but because of the way the internet works, that incubation period didn't really happen for her. You know, there's a lot of classic, amazing, groundbreaking artists who, if you go back in their catalog, you know, they were signed to a label, but there's like that 2, 3, 4 album run at the start where like everything is just kind of eh, you know, and then they eventually like hit that one classic record that becomes their breakout release. And like, that's an amazing record. And then they go on to have an incredible career from there. They have maybe a 4 or 5 album run. That's great. You know, but it's like, you kind of, some people need that runway. Some artists have like an amazing, you know, sort of fully realized sound out of the gate and they drop 1, 2 great records and everything they put out before then sort of like lives in a shadow. Some people need to build up a little bit to get to that point where they actually like, you know, become their full selves as an artist.
I think it's interesting that you bring up Lana Del Rey in that context as well, because I think a lot of the criticisms that you deliver to Addison's debut are similar to what I imagine. I haven't viewed your Born to Die review, if you have one, I didn't go back that far. But I think the general consensus around Born to Die as well was kind of something similar to what you mentioned in your review about Addison. And I do find that when I was revisiting your Addison review, compared to Somber, you tend to focus a lot more on Addison's persona and like who she is and the character that she's playing versus the kind of more structural elements behind that. And I think this might be a raucous poptimist split because I'm a poptimist, right? I'm overly charitable to messy pop girl debuts because I want them to be promising. I'm interested in their development and their growth. But I think
their continued popularity, in order for you to sort of see where you want them to go, their continued popularity depends on that. You know, if somebody out of the gate gets slammed into the Kaya Asylum, the Kia Asylum, the potential of whatever they could become kind of like gets ripped away from them, you know, because like it's literally pop music. You can't continue doing it if you're not pop, if you're not popular,
it's
you
true.
Know, especially if you're trying to operate at the level that Addison is at with, you know, the backup dancers and the production, you know, budget and so on and so forth. Like there needs to be some drive and some oomph there. But I mean, I guess like, you know, I'll let you go on. But I guess like, you know, for me, the split there is like, even if I say the most positive things about this in the world, it doesn't matter how much praise I give it. It's really going to depend upon the fans, you know, because there's a lot of pop artists who I see a ton of potential in, whose work that I love out of the gate. But if the fans aren't there to, you know, push it and praise it and, you know, give it all the love that I think it deserves, it doesn't really matter what I say. You know, it's like the momentum's not going to be there.
Yeah, that's interesting. And I think also we're kind of seeing, as you mentioned, a bit of a reverse happen with your initial takes or just people's general response, I would say, to Somber's first record and Addison's first record. I think the thing about Somber is that he presents as, I think, the kind of artist that you, and I'm going to say you, but I'm actually talking more generally about, I would say, like, traditional music reviewers, because I really view you as kind of the Pitchfork ilk. I do feel like generally your takes, your taste back in the day would align with like what Pitchfork would have decided was like good or bad or great or innovative or interesting. Obviously now they've had a little bit of a poptimist bend, especially with that new editor-in-chief that they brought on in, like, I don't know, 2017, I want to say, when they really started opening up their scope of review to more pop records. I think the issue is that when you see a production like an Addison Rae moment, a lot of people would assume that it is more calculated or more put on than something like a Somber production. Somehow Somber is more inherently more authentic or more real, or that his process is somehow more, I think, in line with what a Muso or like a Raucous would view as real music. And when you look at the way that they actually created these albums, like Somber, I realized this recently, the way that he makes songs a lot of the times is he will write a hook and a verse and put it out on TikTok and basically A/B
test and then decide from there.
If people like it, then he'll go on. I think the Addison creative process, which I think is really interesting, she had all female collaborators, which is very rare in pop music to have three completely, like, totally women working on this project. She was credited as a songwriter on all of these works and very involved in the creative direction as well. So I think sometimes there seems to be the perception of real music versus fake music, that poptism, rocktimism, like, split. And I wonder, do you feel that permeates the way that you approach pop music in general? Are you more suspicious of it inherently because you see it as a branding exercise?
No, I don't think there's such a thing at this point as like real music versus fake music. I think like a lot of I mean maybe there was at one point. I think like maybe that's kind of like a if people are still operating from that standpoint, I think it's like kind of a holdover from the 90s, or if there's any sort of like analog for it now, it's like kind of the difference between music humans have written versus music AI has written. You know, because honestly at this point, like, whether you're looking at the song, and there are songs that I love that have had this quality, songs that I've hated that have had this quality, if you go look at the song and it has like, you know, 13 writers credited on it, you know, There are some people who allow that to completely paint their opinion of the track, which I think is frankly like unfortunate, you know, because there are a lot of great tracks that have that quality. There are a lot of songs that you scroll to the bottom on Apple Music after the lyrics and they have one or two songwriter credits on it and they fucking suck ass. You know,
Shawn Mendes.
It's like,
many examples of that. And like, for riffing off of what you're saying, Beyonce is a great example of someone who is like such an auteur and a curator. And the way that she songwrites is such a specific process of like selectivity and like creating these rooms where it's really her taste and her vision and her eye that is guiding these things. She'll pick like a line for a bridge and one hook here and a verse here. And the effect that has on certain people when they view the writing credits is, well, she had no involvement in the process whatsoever. And I think it's also just another way of creating that diverges from the indie singer-songwriter thing. Gracie Abrams is writing plenty of self-written songs. Would you compare them to a Beyoncé album? No. There's a completely different like level of investment that goes into that. And I think you're right that people really do kind of overestimate authenticity and originality by like who specifically created something.
Yeah, no, I think like... I wouldn't say this is the moment where I developed this opinion, but I feel like one of the most modern-ish examples that I can cite that, that sort of like stand as a prime example of this for me is Beyoncé's self-titled album, which if you go back and watch my review, it's not like the most glowing review. And I obviously like prefer Lemonade much more.
Me too.
To that album, which I mean is an album that's aged amazingly. And, I even would say I like Renaissance a little bit more just, and I know, you know, people love the concept and narrative behind Lemonade and that's valid, but I think Renaissance is just such an amazing ode to so many different eras of dance music. And yeah, as just a fan of genre and a fan of music scenes, a fan of sort of, it's for a lot of the same reasons that I love a record like Daft Punk's Random Access Memories. And I know it's not like their best record by any stretch of the imagination, but like as a music nerd, I love hearing them and hearing Beyonce like nerd out over like, what are my favorite styles of dance music? What are my favorite styles of pop music? Let me come together with my own sort of like compendium of like, you know, here's what speaks to me as an artist who's trying to do a dance thing. So that's just like, you know, fun for me. But with that being said, the Beyoncé self-titled, I feel like, is a fine album. And what sort of really disappointed me was the discourse around, I think, like the Grammys Album of the Year category, where she was competing against Beck for his Morning Phase record. And, that album, in my opinion, sucks. It's not a great Beck record. It's him trying to do a boring country singer-songwriter thing, which he has made folk and country music in the past, but very early in his career, but it was far more interesting than anything he put on that boring-ass album. And a lot of the discourse that I saw around the Beck album getting the praise that it did immediately was like, well, Beyonce doesn't even write her own stuff. She has a bunch of people writing for her. Beck, well, only Beck writes his music, and that's what makes it good, and that's what makes it important. And my reaction was like, no, I'm sorry. Like, I'm judging this based upon what it's like to listen to both these albums, and I don't care that Beck wrote that whole boring ass album by himself.
It doesn't make it better. It doesn't.
I would rather, and another sort of like prime example, and, you know, obviously he's a little Voldemort at this point, but, you know, kind of bouncing back. But another prime example is like Kanye West, you know, is yay. He's somebody who very famously, and this proves that it's like, you know, it's a valid art form. He doesn't write most of his own shit, you know, but he has the knowledge and taste and the background to know what's good and what's not, and to bring on the right people to come on and collaborate with him to do X, Y, or Z. I do feel like also simultaneously, his new record does kind of like display the weak position that you put yourself in as an artist, if that's the way that you work, because the thing is you have to make sure that you're consistently in a place where people are open to working with you. You know, his new album is clearly a record he had to mostly make by himself. And as a result,
I mean, it suffers because of that. You're right. I think people really rely on a collaborative spirit can be a difficult thing, but also Well, I think one of the best parts about creating anything, and actually in any creative genre, I would say like fiction writing might be one of the only places where really solitary influence and creative process is necessary. But in music, it seems like I feel the best stuff that's ever happened has been because multiple people came together and said, let's align on a vision. Let's decide what our project or what our goal is here, and let's work towards it. Let's have a North Star and let's execute based on that. And I think when we suggest that there needs to be just one way to get to that, it gets really boring. But I like this idea that, you know, sometimes being an auteur can lead you to more misfires actually than being a solo entrepreneur. They both have their own pitfalls. I mean, we look at Taylor Swift. I think that opening up her level of songwriting and production interest to people beyond the same five people that she's been working with for 13, 14, 15 years would probably lead to a creative breakthrough for her that is extremely essential for her at this point in her career. But just as, you know, Kanye finds it difficult to get people who actually want to work with him, I think Taylor finds it difficult to relinquish the control, the idea that everything belongs to me and everything that comes from me is the best. Artists, as they get older, it seems, just get more conservative or more kind of like stuck in the way that they've always done things. And I think that's why like there's always the hype about the ingenue, because at least young people have these like full careers ahead of them and not so much like backlog behind them dictating whether people think that the thing they're going to do is great or not. They kind of get to create in a vacuum for the very first time. Yeah, sorry, that was just an inspired tangent based on what you said.
No, I mean, I think it's like something that happens as a result of being successful in the music industry. You put yourself, I think a lot of artists probably, because of the way their careers start, and are often, you know, they're often forced into a place where they might have to make a million compromises that they're not comfortable with making, you know, which like puts them in places where they're having to write and perform and operate at from a position of weakness or stress or anxiety in some way, shape, or form. And, you know, Taylor's an example of somebody who, you know, you, for all the sort of like criticisms and issues that I have, like you can see the way that she talks about sort of like, you know, owning her masters is like clearly something that's like really important and emotional for her. It's like, you know, it's I don't for a second doubt that there's like a real human sort of like emotional response and valid desire that's kind of like, you know, driving that feeling. And when you get to, again, a certain point where you actually do have, you know, the power and influence and validity you've always desired in whatever lane that you're operating, you find yourself being like, hey, I actually don't need to compromise as much as I, you know, used to. And now I'm going to compromise as little as I want, you know, and just do whatever I feel like I'm most comfortable with. And, you know, again, while that is valid because nobody wants to be stressed and nobody wants to be anxious and, you know, nobody wants to feel like they're putting their life on the line just to like create music and create art. Simultaneously, I do feel like challenging yourself as an artist and continuing to challenge yourself as an artist is necessary to make interesting music, to continue to make interesting music into the future. And I get it. Sometimes that challenge in one way can sort of like be misconstrued as like, you know, the challenges and the stress and the anxiety that you could get secondhand from just operating in this toxic, awful ass industry. But sometimes, you know, I think you need to kind of bite the bullet and find a way to separate those two things in your mind so you're not always doing the same shit all the time.
Well, I think also there's fewer and fewer incentives for pop artists specifically to try new things, because I think the algorithms, the industry rewards sameness, and they reward, especially if one thing works, they'll just beat it to death. They'll take something that's interesting and do it over and over again until it completely is sapped of the original inspiration or source of energy that it had, and it's completely dull. I think that's kind of where Taylor's at now, and I would encourage, you know, her to go back to a moment like Folklore, where she really kind of threw the baby out with the bathwater and said, I'm just going to reset a little bit. And that wasn't really like a major creative shift. Like Folklore and Evermore really was her reuniting with instincts and skills that she had honed earlier in her career anyway. I think sometimes like a step forward for any artist doesn't have to be a complete reinvention. It can be a reacquaintance with like a small part of your career or like a little corner that you went into that you didn't really fully excavate. Like those are the moments where I find in pop, you get these like this perfect synergy of like an image rebrand, but also like a sonic refresh. I kind of want that for Lady Gaga next. That's what I'm really feeling that she needs to have, like the sameness, the repetitiveness of what she's doing now, which I thought the latest record was very good. But I think getting stuck in doing the same thing over and over again is a trap that I see pop artists falling into more than other people who are not so reliant on streaming numbers and, you know, having everything be bigger and better than it was before.
Yeah, I echo your sentiment. I feel like the way that the music industry works now, and even pop music works now, is that, you know, once you find your audience, the goal now is to more or less give that core group of people whatever it is that they're going to stream over and over and over and over, as opposed to trying to, you know, lick your finger and put it to the wind in order to sort of like make a judgment call in terms of like where music is moving and sort of like, you know, what wave can I hop on in order to, you know, sort of like judge where things are going next and sort of like make that my thing, or sort of like, you know, see what's burgeoning, see what's coming up, and adopt that or sort of make it my own, or, you know, embrace it in some way. And I actually saw somebody making a funny comment that, I mean, it was apt, but it was almost like kind of brought up in a negative way. And I didn't quite, you know, get it. And it probably just like comes from being from a certain, you know, era of just music in general. But I saw somebody talking about Charlie XCX and kind of like, you know, a lot of her recent album cycles and the direction she's supposed to be moving in next with, like, you know, this rock album.
The dance floor is dead.
Right, exactly. But, you know, the thing is, she could very much be, and given that she is into underground music, she probably is seeing, like, just like I am, a little bit of a resurgence with some of these indie rock bands like Geese and so on and so forth, and the buzz that they're creating online, and thinking, like, maybe this is the direction things are moving in next. And, you know, you could see the fact that early on her adopting, you know, the productions of A.G. Cook and Sophie as, like, you know, her seeing like this new hyperpop thing is like actually maybe the future. And she made like a really good judgment call on that. And, you know, again, the commentary that I was seeing on this was like, Charlie's not somebody who sort of like comes up with an idea within herself. She's like out there sort of like making judgment calls and like what's in the ether and like pulling certain things out that stands out to
disagree.
Her and sort of like jumping on that. I mean, I think there is a degree of truth to that, but simultaneously, and this has been like a bit of a personal kind of like, you know, consumption thing as of late, I've been going back and sort of like, you know, in used bins and the like, just kind of like buying a bunch of old Madonna records that like maybe in the past have only been sort of like, you know, in passing kind of like familiar with, and, you know, like really kind of getting more into them. And, you know, going back to records like Ray of Light, it's like, you know, she's seeing what's happening in electronic music at the time and being like, you know, this is not really in the pop sphere in as loud a way as I think it could be. I'm going to jump on this. I'm going to embrace this. I see this as like a trend. I see this as a scene that I'm going to sort of like, you know, kind of like bring into my world in a way and adopt that. And, you know, I think she was sort of clearly making note of a lot of trends in dance music and pop music that were kind of like coming up when she was developing Erotica, when she was developing a lot of different records, and kind of like embracing that and turning that into her own thing. And I feel like that was more standard practice, you know, in pop music at a certain point. And I, you know, and I don't think that's inherently a bad thing. You know, making note of what else is out there and kind of like embracing it and borrowing from it and kind of altering it in an interesting way. That's what some of my favorite artists do. You know, we've talked before about like LCD Sound System, James Murphy, before on this, show, and we've had previous exchanges, and he's somebody who is very open about like, these are my influences. I'll literally bring like 20 records into the studio with me. And it's like, how can I literally do this, but like, you know, just
surround myself with the experts. I think that's interesting that you mentioned Madonna, because I just went on a journey recently where I listened to Confessions for the first time in full, and I was really blown away by how much of that like predates or directly influences something like, I mean, even Addison, she has a song on it called I Love New York, which is very clearly the inspiration. She's name checked multiple times on that Addison record. But like Madonna's really good at coming up with like a thesis and bringing that through. So I think the idea of confessions on a dance floor, like the dance floor being a place of ritual and confession and pain, not just a place of ecstasy. I mean, specifically in like the early 2000s, that kind of wasn't really the vibe. We were kind of in the midst of like a Timbaland, kind of like a hip hop, R&B, real stronghold over pop music or pop rock. And Madonna was doing something weird and interesting there. And I think for sure, Charlie has that same kind of, she can return to an image or a thought that she's had before. But I would argue that I don't think that Brat was particularly, it felt like kind of a continuation of everything that she'd already been doing. The rock stuff would be more interesting to me if it wasn't her same circle of collaborators. So far, just from what I've seen, it seems to be just A.G. Cook and George that she's working with on this again, which lets me hope that she's bringing in someone else. But I'm really on the rock lookout for a Renaissance Part 3. That's what I'm interested in.
Yeah, given like guitar-driven stuff that I've heard prior in A.G. Cook's work, I am kind of skeptical as well. But, you know, I do know that George's time in the 1975 does make him, you know,
certified
more
banger
than
producer.
Certified banger producer, and he knows his way around a rock band. You know, I feel like he maybe has, you know, with my issues, and I feel like one of the kind of...
That's the question. Really the question. I mean, when you rely on autotune like that, that's kind of back to your point about Kanye. It's like when you rely on one kind of specific thing, if you become too overly reliant on it, you kind of destroy other avenues of possibility. And I think she's made it a point to be like, I can't sing. So I have to use autotune all the time. And so a rock exploration with autotune doesn't sound promising. I'm optimistic, but skeptical.
You know, honestly, there are rock artists and rock bands who have used it in recent years, you know, and either they present it in such a way to where it's way more subtle, like the pitch correction is subtle and it's not like sort of like overtaken in terms of the over and undertones of it. So the voice doesn't sound quite as robotic, but you can tell because the thing is like when they hit a longer note and they really sustain it, it doesn't waver in any way. It's just like, it just sounds almost like a synth. And then you can really tell, you know what I mean? But, you know, I would hope Charlie would, for me, it's not so much whether or not this album does or doesn't have autotune. I think there are different contexts in which that could potentially work. For me, it's whether or not like the instrumentation sounds live, you know, and that's not to say that like, you know, to me, it's almost like one of the prime kind of factors of like what makes a rock record really a rock record. And I know a lot of people just like kind of see rock as like, you know, just guitar and just guitar driven music. For me, it's like really about the drums much of the time and how sort of like organic and fluid the groove of the song feels. I feel like, you know, dance music and the way that it's kind of like, you know, quantized and produced, there's almost like a rigidity to it, which is fine. It works for that genre. It works for the context in which that's supposed to sort of like, you know, feel in the club, you know, in the spaces that is performed live. Whereas like, you know, a rock performance or a rock recording, I feel like when it's at its best, there is almost kind of like, you know, a lightning in a bottle kind of like energy to it that you can only get if there are some elements of it that are kind of like tracked organically, you know, and then the rest of sort of the movement of the piece kind of follows that. And look, there are great rock records that have not been made that way and do have more of a rigid feel to them. But I feel like, you know, if she really wants this album to feel different and this era to feel different and unique from anything that she's done before, I feel like that might be, you know, kind of like a prime factor. And she has like flirted with rock music in the past on Sucker, but that record famously is not really.
I just want to break the rules. I mean,
it's funny how nearly every record since Brat. And you know, this again is coming from somebody who has not always been a fan of Charlie, but I have loved a majority of what she's done since, the Vroom Vroom EP, because I thought that was really kind of like a landmark kind of, you know, moment of change and evolution for her. But it's funny how in the wake of Brat, nearly everything she has done, even her unreleased XCX World album has like undergone a critical reassessment among the pop girls and pop fans, like, wait, you know, there's something here I didn't miss before, I didn't pay attention to. But Sucker is the one record where people like are still kind of uniformly like, yeah,
no, because they're going to True Romance and saying that's the best thing I've ever heard,
right?
And skipping over Sucker. And I think that's also partly because Charlie hates Sucker too. She's made it pretty clear that she's not happy with the compromises that she was forced to make artistically in those moments. I'm curious, what did you think about the Wuthering Heights record? Did you feel like that was a meaningful departure from what she's been doing before? It felt like a very natural extension of Brat and even of How I'm Feeling Now and the stuff that had come before that to me.
There's some cool experiments on it. I like the John Cale track. I like how noisy she's willing to get on that record. And there are a few tracks that are giving me True Romance vibes that I feel like are very catchy and well written. But for the most part, I kind of see the record as a detour. You know, like it's got its moments, but I think Pitchfork in a blurb said something like, the best thing about Wuthering Heights is the soundtrack that Charlie did. For the movie.
No, it is. Yeah. I mean, the film.
So,
yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, I echo that very much, but like, I don't think it's like one of her best projects or anything like that. You know, I like it more than Sucker. I'll say that.
I'm ready for Beyoncé Renaissance Part 3, the rock edition. Hayley Williams said she can
That's also a rumor too. Interested. Maybe maybe Charlie does know. She is making the right call. Maybe Beyonce is going to do the rock record too. You know, if there's like three big pop girlies in the next like couple of years that all decide to do a rock album. You know, with that being said, though,
maybe
I was kind of surprised
Watch the Throne,
that
Beyonce and Charlie. Maybe that's what it is.
You know, as much as I do think that like this is a potential exciting possibility, by that same token, I was kind of surprised to not hear as much guitar-driven production on the new Olivia track. She seems to, you know, and she's always got, you know, a softie or two or three or four on each record. But I'm surprised to sort of see her lead with that, you know, with this new single, which I thought was very catchy and well written. But, you know, I think does share a lot of, especially with Dan in the mix, like a lot of overlap with like what we've heard recently with Chapel. You know, and
interesting,
and
I've heard that
and the
take
way her music's produced. Yeah,
come up multiple times, I think. Olivia, to me, is trying to, she's in that kind of difficult transition period where she's aging up. And I think that what she was doing before was very Avril Lavigne coded, even if it was more complex than anything Avril Lavigne's ever done. I love you, Avril, but like, that's true. Even if it was more advanced and developed than that, I think that she had a bit painted herself into a corner. and Guts and Sour, to me, are like Folklore and Evermore. It's like a continuation of one thing. Sour didn't really feel ready to be put out as a record to me, and Guts kind of fills in the blanks there. So this is Olivia's, in my opinion, first like true creative detour or breakout of that moment. But there is a lot of like live instrumentation on it, I suppose. It's not, you're right, that like guitar, electric guitar heavy moment for her. I believe that this record contains more of a similar thing. It seems that from what I've read about it, from the Vogue article that she did, there's like a lot of synth involvement here. The California surf rock is a reference I've heard come up over and over again. She seems to have been imbibing a lot of Blur content while making this record. It's going to be really interesting to see how she distills all of these influences, because Drop Dead is kind of like not what I thought it was going to be, but I love it.
No, I think it's a good track too, and a good start for this this album cycle. But I do agree, this could be a record where she's like trying to break that conception of like, oh, she's a kind of like young, bratty,
angsty,
punky
girl,
immature. Yeah. Like immature kind of person. And now she's going to be like, this is me doing a more mature thing. You know,
I'm happy to hear that, but I still want some Olivia Rodrigo being a brat. I do like that. She's kind of the original brat. I'm interested in it. I think we've veered so far off topic. I'm sorry for keeping you for so long. I want to just finish with a question. Actually, I have two questions I want to finish with you. Do you think that what we're doing here today is just old school criticism on a new platform, or do you think that it's turning into something structurally different? And where do you see music criticism developing? And maybe the next 10 years is kind of too long of a runway for what we do, maybe 5 years.
I feel like that's at least like what I'm trying to do, you know, and I don't, and not to say that like, you know, old school music criticism is like all that or perfect or like, you know, this, era that personally I'm idealizing. I guess like what I'm trying to hold up is like what a lot of people would perceive to be, you know, just like a perception of how that industry might have worked at one time. Like when you go back to like, even the blog era and the Pitchfork era that I was getting started, there was a lot of like, you know, quid pro quo. Quid pro quo, essentially pay for play. You give us this positive, you know, sort of like coverage, and we'll give you an exclusive access to this or that and the other thing, which is going to drive, you know, traffic to your platform. You know, our artists will play your festival if they get a positive review. It's not like a great time in terms of conflict of interest. You know, it's like if anything, the criticisms I was making of some of these newer TikTok creators now, it's just a different version of that. You know?
Right. Yeah.
But like, you know, I think in a lot of ways still like in my own way trying to hold up like that view of like a stuffy kind of stuffy-ish critic who just kind of like has their opinions and sticks to them. I try to be a little bit more kind of silly or relatable or make it clear that I don't take myself that seriously, even if I do have like staunchly held opinions on certain things. You know, that's sort of like the thing that I'm trying to do. And I feel like there's a question that people need to sort of like ask themselves. And I've been thinking about this more in the context of music, but I feel like, and these are not mutually exclusive, but I feel like there's definitely key differences between artists and entertainers. And there are a lot of entertainers who think they're artists, and I don't think they really are. And again, that's not like a commentary between like what's real or fake in terms of music. But like, I feel like a true artist will have the capacity or show the capacity to say no to their audience at some point and go with their gut and take a risk and do something that they know their audience
potentially put them off.
Right. Potentially. And I feel like, you know, people on the internet, if you are going to commentate on music, you have to decide whether or not you are going to be a critic or whether or not you are going to just like be an influencer, you know, and there are valid ways to go about both, but you know, really ask yourself before you talk about music on the internet, do you think you are going to have the capacity to get online and give a strong opinion, a negative one, about something that you think people might not necessarily be ready to hear, you know,
and withstand?
And you know, look, I'll tell you, even if you do look at it from the long-term point of view, there are a lot of records that I've said sucked and people really kind of came back around on that opinion, you know, down the road. But when that happens, nobody comes back and says to you like, oh, hey, good job.
Oh, you were so right. It's true. Yeah.
Oh, you were so right. Nobody says that. Nobody says that. So it's like, it truly is like,
when you say it, right, and then it's crickets.
Right. It's so it truly is thankless. You know, it's like, so I mean, you can't, and look, that's, and the reason I continue to do it is because there are other reasons I enjoy doing it. The reasons I enjoy doing it aren't tied to whether or not people agree with me. And that's the thing that you need to sort of like explore or decide. Yeah.
This is not a good arena of content creation to go into because most of the time you are fielding people that are extremely angry and upset with you. So you have to kind of be aligned with a purpose greater than that. I like what you said about wanting to withhold some sort of music critic standard from yonder year. I think I love to read music criticism, and part of why I do it via video, I write all my scripts, but part of the reason why I do it in this medium is because I know that people just don't read anymore. So part of like being a good communicator is like trying to meet people where they are, finding them on whatever platform they're at and adapting what you want to do to that. In an ideal world, I would love to just write my reviews and just have them go out and that be it. But that's just not the way that we consume things anymore. And there are positives and negatives to like the industry developing in that way. But I think if you want to approaching it with rigor, I think is harder, but ultimately more rewarding. Leading on to that, if the algorithm disappeared tomorrow and you didn't have to like prioritize the Lady Gaga album first, you didn't have to condense everything into short form, you could take your time with something, you had no pressure, what kind of criticism would you like to make? Would you want to do like a long essay or a book or a documentary? Would you want to do fewer but deeper reviews? How would you fulfill that desire if that pressure was kind of taken off of you?
It would be a lot like it was when I first started my YouTube channel, you know? I guess I could say like, and maybe that sounds like a little bit boring, but I do truly have like, I think the privilege and, I'll just say the privilege to be doing something that I actually like doing and having started it at the right time. If I actually started what I was doing right now, I might have a difficult time sort of getting it to where it is at this point. Doing it exactly the way that I I originally did it. I think that, you know, reactions to certain things that I would have said would be harsher, would break containment faster. I would, you know, there'd probably be a lot of people in the music industry that would be like, let's snuff this out before it gets too big.
Let's get him alive. Yeah.
You know, exactly. That sort of thing. So, you know, I'm very lucky to have started what I started at the time that I did, because it was really the right time. If anything, I could have started 2 years earlier, and, you know, not that it would have made a world of difference, but like, yeah, I really did start what I started at like the right time and in the right way. And, you know, and look, I mean, I've been covering Lady Gaga's music for years, and I do feel like, the way things have sort of like developed in terms of like how content and the internet works, it has forced me, I feel like, to reckon a little bit more with, you know, sort of what's going on in popular music. And I feel like that has made me sort of like appreciate certain things more that maybe I didn't when I was like, you know, as you were kind of using these terms earlier, like maybe a little bit more of a rockist and starting from that standpoint. You know, I think that's like kind of the case for all the genres that I cover on a regular basis now. I feel like, you know, my approach has been to be more of a generalist, because I find all music interesting, you know, even if it's not like, you know, something that I grew up listening to as much as other genres or whatever. I grew up at least on a baseline level enjoying, you know, particular artists in certain lanes and certain sort of like categories. But whether or not I sort of like, you know, had the capacity to do a deep dive in the mid-90s as a, you know, a child who just turned 10, you know, was like not always in my control. But still, I feel like kind of, you know, pushing myself in that generalist direction has forced me to, you know, come to places that I don't think I would have if I was only put in a place where I didn't have to sort of like compromise or push myself out of my comfort zone. Like, you know, if I only was able to ever kind of like review exactly what I wanted to review and only play to what feels right naturally or inherently or aesthetically, would I be in a place where I'm like listening to and freaking out over the new Miley Cyrus album? Probably not. You know, probably yeah. not. Honestly.
No, truly a verse king, you know? A verse king. I think your versatility is something that really makes you stand out as a creator, like your ability to approach different kinds of music with the same rigor, I think is really impressive. And, you know, as a niche creator, I have very specifically picked a very specific niche. I mean, it was even more niche before when I first started. It was just Taylor Swift before I decided to expand my lens, which I had been doing like behind the scenes, but not on camera, I suppose. I think, you know, even when I'm approaching something that feels even a little bit out of my wheelhouse, sometimes I can feel a little bit overwhelmed or intimidated. So I think it's a really nice example to have someone that is able to apply that rigor so widely and so frequently. I don't know how you make the amount of content that you do. It truly baffles me, because I know you have stuff going on. You're not a person with a lot of free time. So when you say internet's the busiest music nerdy, he means it.
I'm trying to live up to that title every day. But you know, it's like I feel like there's also legitimacy to going in the niche direction too. I feel like you know, as a generalist,
if you're just starting out now, it's probably easier.
It depends, you know. I think they're both necessary and they're both important. I feel like a lot of what I'm able to do is based upon the work and the discourse of niche music creators and fans, you know, because the thing is, often when I am coming across something and I'm early to it, it's because I'm tapped into sort of like maybe discourse and conversations that, you know, really big fans of a particular style of music are sort of like, oh, this is really good. Like, we're really hype about this. Like, you know, let's talk about it. Let's recommend it to Anthony. Let's, you know, have some conversations about how good we think it is. And if that wasn't happening, like from the bird's eye view that I try to like view everything, I would miss most things. You know, yeah. It's like I would pretty much be stuck just like, you know, either reviewing just what I have the ability to sort of like be ground zero for, or only what I'm sort of like seeing as like kind of the most popular or, you know, tippy top. You know, it's the niche creator grind is an admirable one, in my opinion.
Thank you. I'll keep holding down the fort.
Please do.
I will Swiftologize until the day I die. Thank you for coming back.
Thank you for having me on again. I think these crossovers really brighten a lot of people's days, from what I've noticed.
They like it. Some of them hate it, but most of them like it, I would say. And I think that's kind of how I would describe both of our careers at this moment.
You know, who can resist not pulling up to watch, two chops team up for a joint flop?
Be chopped together. No, literally, exactly. Two flops maximizing their joint flop. That is literally what this is. Thank you, everyone, for tuning into the Loser Fest.
Right, exactly, yeah.